Welcome back to this episode of the Strong Kind Podcast. This episode is with Joe Padula. Joel is a strength and conditioning coach and consultant. He works at the University of Oklahoma, and he is involved in their softball program and with golf. Super knowledgeable guy. This guy was an amazing person to talk to. Loves to train. He's also got an awesome story with his own overcoming or managing type 1 diabetes. It was a great conversation with Joe. You can find him at Padula Performance on Instagram, and I'll link his other links at the end of the show. But thanks for being here. Appreciate you, and have fun with this conversation. I know I did. I should have hit record before I asked you about your mustache, but I just like to jump in. So, because you have a Top Gun mug right there, so do you identify as Goose or Maverick?
No, I certainly don't identify as either, but I was Goose for Halloween one year.
You kind of look like Goose. I don't know if that's good.
That's what people say sometimes.
Goose is a very admirable. It was a damn shame that they killed Goose off, because he was really what held Maverick together. And you know, without Goose, Maverick doesn't go anywhere, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So, I loved the second Top Gun.
Oh my gosh, it was awesome.
I loved it. Yeah, it was very, very good.
Very good. Yeah, great movie. And I didn't know Val Kilmer had like throat cancer, which sucks. And like he legitimately couldn't talk, which is why he was, you know, they played him that way, which I don't know. Man, Val Kilmer, that guy's been in some awesome. Have you ever seen the movie Heat?
I believe I have, but I it's slipping my mind right now.
Dude, it's Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Oh,
like
yes, yes,
heist.
Yes, yes, yes.
Val Kilmer's one of the robbers. It's so good, man. But yeah, I really like Val Kilmer. So I did. So, all right, man, I'll kind of just, you posted like your story a couple days ago.
Right.
And I've been wanting to ask you to come on my podcast, anyway, but, your story's awesome. So
thank you.
I kind of wanted you to recap your story a little bit. Actually, I'm going to pull it up just so I can give like the big pieces here. I'm just creeping on your Instagram here. So you're currently at Oklahoma, correct?
I am.
What teams do you work with?
So I work for softball and women's golf.
Okay.
So softball is the widely recognized program. I was a part of the fourth championship in a row across the last 4 years. So they've gone back to back to back to back. So when I got the opportunity to come down here, it was mainly, you know, softball's looking for a new strength coach. And then, you know, a lot of these money-making sports, it's like you always help out with some other teams that might be a little smaller. So like golf is my second team. Like our baseball strength coach has men's golf. A lot of the Olympic strength coaches have numerous teams.
Gotcha. And so you're, just to touch on like the big pieces, like you were so you were an infielder. You converted to pitcher though. So you,
I did.
You started pitching in college. You were throwing 75 miles an hour. Which, yeah. Dude, I just read Moneyball. If you've never read Moneyball, go read Moneyball if you're a baseball fan at all. But 75 miles per hour in college is, you know, it's tough, right? I can't throw that.
It's real bad.
I'm not critiquing you. I'm just saying like there's probably, because like what people are basically looking for is a lot of times your speed or your movement, right? So
right.
But then you got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, right? So
yeah.
How old were you when you got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
17.
Okay. So
no. Because it was the winter of 17, so I was 18. Yeah, so it's been 7 years.
Okay. Because was it because you were hospitalized that they figured out that you were diabetic? Like, did you have like some form of like complications due to it, or what happened?
No, so it was like I said in my post, I was kind of ignoring symptoms for a long time.
Okay, yeah.
So initially, you know, I was never a really big dude. I mean, I've always hovered, when I was in high school, I hovered around 165, 170. You know, I was never a huge jacked guy. So I was always pretty lean. And I always ate what I felt like was healthy. You know, I wasn't like a junkie or a, you know, type 1 diabetics also do not come in my family. We've never had a type 1 diabetic in my family, which, you know, you're usually told like this is a genetic thing that's passed down. You know, this is a hereditary genetic thing. So something must have happened. At doctors are speculating that it was immunizations that I got when I was younger that could have caused some kind of genetic mutation that caused the pancreas to dysfunction in the way that it is. But anyway, I had been training very hard. You know, freshman fall, you really go hard. I was lifting probably 6 days a week with the upperclassmen. I was getting stronger. I felt really good, and then it got to a point in the fall season where I was having blood sugar crashes like before every practice, and then the blood sugar crashes stopped, and then I was met with dry mouth, frequent urination. I'm talking like 15, 20 times a day urinating, leaner as like all get out. I mean, I had like ab veins. I had veins in places I didn't even know there were veins. Like I was like the lowest percent body fat you could have without like dying. I mean, I had zero body fat on me. I was also hungry 24/7. I had completely insatiable hunger and thirst. Any soreness that I had, like muscular soreness from training, was taking a long time to recover, like abnormally longer, like 2 to 3 days longer than you would expect for like a normal training bout. I was, like I said, pounding water. Any bruises or cuts that I sustained, like just, you know, normal injuries that you would sustain, like took a long time. Like a paper cut would take like 2 weeks to heal. Like little things like that were just bizarre. So then I came back for the winter break, and then I got checked. They ran a blood sugar test in the office right there, and they were like, "Your blood sugar is almost 6 to 7 times what it should be." I mean, in a normal person, your blood sugar should be like 83 milligrams per deciliter, somewhere between there and 90 milligrams if you're fasting. I mean, that a number like that is not even pre-diabetic. That's like you are in ketoacidosis. You know, if you get checked and your blood sugar is like 100 milligrams per deciliter, like you're gonna get marked down as a pre-diabetic. So even that small bit of change is glaring for a medical practitioner or doctor. So where I was at was like, we can't even believe you're here, like type of situation. So
I've checked a lot of blood sugars, and if I would have saw one that high, I would have been like shit in my pants. So
it's really dangerous, very, very dangerous. It's at it's they tell you shouldn't be exercising at all if your blood sugar's above like 300. I'd probably been training like an animal for I don't know how many weeks or months at blood sugar levels like that. So.
All right, so just to keep like going into kind of like you, I'm assuming you were a high school sport, a high school athlete, correct? What'd you
Yeah.
play in high school?
I was a baseball player through and through. I never really played any other sports at a remotely high level. And I was always a position player, and I had pitched here and there for my club team, but never for high school. So I had the exposure to pitching, and I did pitch during some tournaments, but I never developed and actually like took it full on, and tried to be the best I could at it. I always thought I was going to be an infielder, so.
So you, man, it's so wild because like so much I've just really gone down kind of like the stress physiology rabbit hole. More so, so I'm a physical therapist by background, and your experience with physical therapy resonated with me a lot. But man, I just think about like stress on the organism, like 17-year-old kid that wants to work his ass off, or 18-year-old kid that wants to work his ass off, and also just mental and cognitive and physical stress, and like who knows where it went, but like, yeah, there could have been something in genetic, and then definitely something affected your genetic, but it just also is like, and I want to get into this because I want to get into like what you love about training so much. But do you think like there was just an aspect of like you just crushing the shit out of yourself to some extent at that time frame too that kind of set the stage a little bit, or what do you think?
You know, I have thought about that, and I can't say that that's a contributing factor, to be honest, because I had been, in my post, I make a comment that I never had a strength coach. That's referring to college. I had a strength coach in high school, and it was like hard nosed, like military style, like old school training. I mean, we got our asses kicked. So I had been exposed to that kind of exertion level. I mean, what I was doing in high school, I think far exceeded anything that my college program expected of me. And I never had any issues. You know, I had a normal well visit before I went to college. Like everything was fine. I did blood tests every year, like every normal, person should do just to check that stuff. And I had no problems. Something happened in that fall or maybe at that visit, because I did receive some immunizations. I don't remember what they were.
Yeah.
And I'm not a conspiracy theorist either. I'm not going to sit here and say like, but things happen like that, you know? So,
it's really hard to find a causal factor for anything in the human ecosystem. Right.
For sure. Yeah.
I was just curious if you had felt like there was like signs that it was coming in high school or like, you know, and then like, dude, also like, type 1 diabetes is a freaking, like, I knew a kid in high school, like, no signs of it. And then, unfortunate incident, like, he, like, passed out in his bathtub, and they found out that he was type 1 diabetic, and nothing happened, right?
It is a terrifying, not to,
scare anybody, but, yeah.
Not to, I don't know what the word is, like, ask for sympathy, but it is a very, very scary disorder.
Yeah.
It can hit you fast. The amount of workouts that I've had to stop and just sit there and wait for 30 minutes for my blood sugar to return to normal levels, cause I might've like overdosed on a little bit. Cause I, sometimes your insulin works a lot better if you're doing certain physical activity. I mean, the temperature outside could impact how your insulin works. There's so many factors that could impact how well your body responds to medication. And insulin is such a fast acting drug that it could really mess you up if you're not careful. And there's so many dietary implications as well that I've educated myself on, like the, slow release carbohydrates versus fast release, the timing of either one, the timing of literally how you eat the plate of food in front of you. Like there's actually research that says like if you eat the protein in your plate. So for lunch, for instance, today I had 8 ounces of steak, an avocado. I had some grated Parmesan Reggiano, and then I had 2 slices of sourdough. The sourdough is the last thing I ate on that plate because fats and proteins, if you eat them first, they slow the gastric emptying rate. So, but if I were to eat the sourdough first, the blood sugar response would be higher. So I think that's extremely interesting.
Yeah.
Like little tricks like that and just dietary things that, I mean, I eat very clean, I think. And that's mainly because of my diet or my condition, but a lot of important factors.
You home make that sourdough or is that store bought?
That's store bought, but I do usually go to this farmer's market in Norman. Then this lady prepares some really good bread. I usually stick to that stuff or rice.
Have been making sourdough, and I made a loaf yesterday that was crap. It was complete dog crap. It didn't work at all. My wife's a lot better at it than me, but I'm working on it. It's a skill for sure. But sourdough is the bomb, man. Good sourdough. So,
and
all right.
I've also one more thing on that. Interesting thing about sourdough. I've spoken to other diabetics.
Yeah,
they say like the one bread that doesn't impact their blood sugar as much is sourdough. So there's something about how it's made, or maybe it's like the fermentation process, but the glycemic index of sourdough is very low, and my insulin demands when I eat that are also a lot less.
Yeah, I mean, it's just having made it. I mean, there's all the core ingredients are flour. Like you have a sourdough starter, which is like its own like fermentation process.
Right.
That's like the thing that kicks it off. But then it's just a bunch of flour, salt, and water. Right. So it's like it's carbohydrate, obviously there's sugar, but like there's nothing added to it. Right. It's like literally just like what bread used to be type of thing. Right. Which is a very different thing. And it's, yeah, we make it homemade. We try to make a couple loaves a week. It's so good. It's hard not to just keep polishing it off. But yeah. I have a few other friends that are type 1 diabetic, and that, you know, just the importance of managing your dietary intake, managing, you know, your insulin, checking, like, you know, what your responses are to certain foods and that type of stuff, is definitely somebody that, like me, I just take it for granted at this current juncture because I don't really have to manage any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I do want to get into, okay, so, like, diehard baseball guy. So you were with the Kansas City Royals, TCU Athletics. Like, well, okay, so you did talk about this, and I feel you, because PT, mainstream PT is kind of garbage. It's not kind of garbage. It's garbage, especially for people who are athletes a lot of times, right?
Yeah.
And then you mentioned, you know, strength coaching, and what was it that drove you maybe to be more of a strength coach as opposed to maybe just becoming like a baseball coach or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, I've always had a thing for anatomy. I love the way the body works. I love physiology. I think I understand that aspect and can communicate it and effectively, like, create the positive adaptations in that area better than skill coaching. I've done skill coaching. I've done pitching lessons. I've helped people with their throwing over the internet. Like, I used to have remote clients, but that really wasn't what I enjoyed so much. I think the main thing with PT that I initially saw and felt was, the body is so much more adaptable than we're making it out to be. Like, this is the extent of what we're doing with this individual. Like, and they don't have any other trainers or anything like that. We're expecting them to go back into the situation that they got injured in and expect to be fine. Like, the number one thing is, like, nothing that we're doing on a table is going to prepare them for the rate of force, the amount of force that they're sustaining, the cognitive aspects of what's happening. I mean, we know from research, like ACLs, for example, there's a massive cognitive and skill aspect to the mechanisms of those injuries and the interpretation of the environment. It's gotten to a point now where, like in soccer and sports like lacrosse or field hockey, where you have an open field and you're reacting to an ever-developing play. Now, things like, you hear the term in recent years, like small-sided games, where you're simulating the interpretation of external stimuli and information coming in at high speeds. And you actually, people have spoken about, like Fergus Connolly in his book Game Changer, like progress the speed of the game, for example, things like that. So that, I think those things are very, very well-intentioned and well-constructed models, because there are skill components to these injuries. They're not just all physical. And even if they were just physical, I again, like I said before, the stuff on the table does not prepare them for those things. And I think physical therapy too gives a lot of athletes, like, this is what you should be doing to prepare. And there's just so much more to it. I think it's just kind of a disservice, like, no insult to physical therapists. Like, I think there are a lot of amazing PTs out there. Just my situation was not my cup of tea.
Well, and it, like, to be completely honest, every time I shadowed a PT, I'm like, this isn't what I want to be doing. I was like, yeah, I want to be doing something else, right? And humans are not, we are a skeleton, right? We are a musculoskeletal system, but we're also, like, we're this, I'm reading freaking, if you've never read this, dude, complex or
thinking in systems.
I'll send you the link, Donella Meadows. But
okay,
we're a dynamic system, right? And you're right. Like, I can never remember what study this was, but it's like, female soccer players, like, were most likely to tear their ACL during, like, finals week or after a breakup or, like, a relationship problem, right? I can't remember where that study came from, but
I think I've seen the same study you're talking about.
Yeah. And you're right, man. Like, you know, like, the really simple thing that I say to a lot of people is, like, well, you kind of, and this is a simplification, but, like, people get hurt when they get fooled. Right. And it's not even that they got fooled. It's that, like, the prediction they're trying to make is in a mismatch with what their actual output is, and boom, you know, stuff happens. And I need to check out Fergus Conley. Is somebody, I think it was Will Rattell that also talked about Fergus Conley, and I need to check out some of his stuff because it's just, yeah. And this is why I like talking to so many different coaches and stuff, is because we're, a lot of us are coming at the same problem from these slightly different perspectives with all these slightly different inputs. And it's like a really awesome way to synthesize information. And it's really cool. I like that you almost, and it's not to say, yeah, you like the skill coaching aspect of sport, but being preparing people to play sport well is super cool. You also like to train pretty freaking hard, apparently.
Yeah.
Where does that stem from?
I think the number one thing that I always told myself is that I'm going to be the walking and living embodiment of everything I want my athletes to do. I think that that's stage one of buy-in. Like, can you demonstrate these things yourself, and are you proficient in these skills that you want to teach? And have you reaped the benefits, and like, are you the living proof of the things that you're saying work? Because if you're not, like, how can you confidently say to someone else, this works? I just don't know how. If I were doing that, I would feel like an imposter. Like, I would have imposter syndrome if I advocated for something, but I never felt its benefits myself. That's number one. Number two is I just want to see how far the human body can go. And I want to prove my initial speculation in physical therapy right. Like, the body is going to adapt for as long as you force it to, and as long as you can believe it can be adapted. Like, it's, I'm 25 years old. I've been training like a high performance athlete since I was 14, and I'm still finding new ways to progress. And something I want to say about that too, with how long I've been able to progress and how much of a late bloomer I am. Like, I was at the peak of my athletic career when I was 21. And I stopped playing baseball at that point because I wanted to get into the field and start working. But I think that people are just very fast to progress things. I don't think people are patient enough in training. Yeah. It's like, dude, like, I don't know how much skin in the game you have if you think you need to change things up every 2 to 3 weeks. Like, yeah, for the sake of variation and engagement, like, okay, I could see that. But you don't need to be doing all these sophisticated training models and periodization schemes. Like, I have been riding the same periodization model in my training for like 4 years. I'm still making progress. I use a simple, like, linear model, like, just, you know, 4 or 5 weeks ascending, back off for 1 week, 4 or 5 weeks ascending, back off. Like, I've never tinkered with all this block periodization stuff and all this, you know, undulating models and conjugate sequential models. And like, I understand the science behind it and what people are trying to say. And I have put myself through some of these situations before, like in some of these models, but the results have never been as good as just a concurrent, balanced training model where you're focusing on a couple things at once. And yeah, I mean, I think I just summed up all I wanted to say right there, but
like, my overarching,
people are too impatient is what I'm trying to say.
My overarching theory with a lot of this is like, we're trying to manage people's lack of patience and the fact that they typically just accumulate too much fatigue in too much of a short period of time. Right. And they starts to decrease in performance. And there's a lot of, and like, cause I'm with you too. Like, I like a little bit of variety in my training, but the variety is like, hey, close grip bench press to normal grip bench press to, you know, slightly wider or incline, right? Like,
yeah.
Or, you know, like slight little tweaks with the overarching. And like, I agree too. I also, before I went to PT school, I was a CrossFit coach, which there's, you know, there's a lot of things wrong with CrossFit, but there's nothing wrong with CrossFit. Like, meaning like, if you do CrossFit and you enjoy it, great. Right. But like,
it's its own sport.
It's its own thing. Right. I kind of fell in love with CrossFit when it was very early CrossFit. And it was like, hey, you do like a 30-minute gymnastics workout. And then the next day you go run 5K. And then the next day, maybe you do a Metcon, which it very much morphed into. You do all that stuff 6 days a week. And that's not really kind of, I just don't think it's like as good of a GPP program in that sense as it could be, whatever. Right. But like you said, Yeah, I think my biggest thing, I'm 36, and it's funny because I finally have started to learn the lesson of like this, the slower you're willing to go, the more progress you're going to make. And the slow, it's kind of like the slower you're willing to go, you actually make a shit ton of progress in a 6 week period of time. Whereas when you're trying to make a bunch of progress in a 6 week period of time, you don't make that much because you're just banging your head against the wall. It's like a really freaking, it's paradoxical, right? But
two things I want to comment on. First, to your point about trying to aim for something, and like, I mean, I tried to sprint 22 miles per hour by the time 2024 ended.
Yeah.
And every week was like, oh, not again, not again, not again. I'm not there. I'm not there. And you just like, I mean, that's the, what's that, that law, Goodhart's law, where it's like, you try to satisfy the metric and the metric ceases to no longer have any value. Like,
yes,
you should be, I should be hitting 22 miles per hour as a result of many different things. It shouldn't be the one specific like target, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And when you hyper specify like that, you end up sacrificing a lot of other good things. Like I said, and I did a lot of posts on drop catches and my thoughts on them, and that like reflexive lifting model that people are experimenting with. Like my body composition negatively changed, my concentric impulse negatively changed. My RSI got better. My time to take off got better. A lot of these speed metrics got better, but my overall force capacity and ability to produce maximal force tanked. So it's like, well, yeah, this method might have some efficacy, but how much should we let it be dominating our program? So that just goes back to my point of like having a well-rounded general program and sprinkling that stuff in here and there. The other thing I wanted to mention you just talked about was like managing impatience. And actually, one of the things that plays to my advantage in the collegiate setting is that athletes like routine.
Yeah.
So, like, I can get away with programming the same thing for 6 to 8 weeks and no one's going to bat an eye because they're creatures of habit. So these athletes don't always need the variation. Like, it's not like if someone were coaching me and they gave me the same piece of paper 8 weeks in a row, which is not what I'm doing. But if someone gave me the same piece of paper 8 weeks in a row, I'd be like, dude, can we try something else? Like, I'm going to get stale here. You know what I mean? But athletes who don't know any better aren't going to ask that question. Yeah, they don't care at all. So that actually plays to your advantage as a collegiate strength coach.
When so I play basketball one or two times a week. When I'm playing basketball, I don't care about what my training looks like. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I get in the gym and lift. As long as it's like and I've also just generally gotten to this point where I've finally stopped looking for like the secret sauce and been like, these are the principles, right? These are the principles. This is what you want to do. Like I'm going to compete in like an Olympic lifting meet because it's fun and it's a good way to push, but worrying about it's 100%. Like you said, Goodhart's law. When I worry about what I can snatch and clean and jerk, my snatch and clean and jerk performance goes down. I just focus on trying to get stronger and moving the bar well. And, you know, like it's crazy too, because Olympic lifts are just such a, and I want to get into your arguments against power training per se. I think that's what I saw. I think like you're just basically saying like power isn't something like that. It's not, I guess it's maybe not an output. We're going to get into that. I want to get your take, but like, my point there is like when I just focus on like doing the thing well, right? Like some days when you go do like a clean, it's going to move pretty snappy and that's like, okay, then you go up. When it doesn't move snappy at a percentage that it should move snappy, you're like, all right, this isn't my day. And you like hang it up, right? Or you just do a few more sets and call it good. Whereas in the past on those bad days, I try to keep pushing through, right? And then you have a deterioration in performance that probably affects you mostly mentally, and then you get frustrated and all.
For sure.
Right. So, but let's talk about power, because I think like your point is basically, and I think a lot of other people are starting to pick up on this. It's like, well, tell me what your stance on power is first. I just want to make sure we're on the right page. I'm on the right page with you.
I think that power is just a descriptor of what you're doing in the weight room. It's not it's not a biomotor quality. Power is an equation that describes a certain output. So it's force times velocity, right?
Yep.
Or it's, you know, work divided by time. Okay, that just to put it simply, every single exercise you ever do will have a power output. That doesn't mean that peak power is the best thing to be shooting for in the weight room. So the way that I kind of look at my training, considering the fact that it's not an output, and my explanation here will help to answer the question, the initial question, but you have maximal strength on one side, you have maximal velocity on the other side. The stuff in the middle ground, I kind of associate that to like the Charlie Francis argument, like it's not fast enough to elicit top end speed, it's not slow enough to induce cardiovascular adaptations and create new capillary networks and things like that. That's how I look at power training. It's not heavy enough to elicit maximal strength gain, nor is it light enough to elicit maximal velocity. That doesn't mean that we never lift in the middle. So like I'm gonna call the power zone the middle, okay? You got like max force, max velocity, and then you got the middle. The reason that you should train in the middle is not to pursue more power output. The reason you do it, and the training would be the same between like me and someone else who's like a power advocate. So I'm not trying to get into semantics right now, but like the reason you go there is what I want people to be clear on. You lift lighter weights faster to preserve yourself so that you can develop the maximal velocity side with more freshness and more quality. That's my take on it. It's not like it's its own quality. So
you're kind of saying what I was just saying there, when like if my performance starts to deteriorate on like a clean day or whatever, it's like just freaking do it at a weight that you move pretty fast and call it a day, as opposed to like, you know, doing kind of, it's okay to do shitty reps, but it's also kind of not if your goal is to not do shitty reps. Do you know what I mean? Are we on the same page there?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with what you just said, but I'm not talking about like bad reps, or like if you don't get your max that day, go lighter. What I'm talking about is like, let's talk about like a 4 to 5 week block where people say we're developing power, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And like, let's say they're hovering between 55 to 80%, just spitballing percentages. You know, I think we would agree that that's not like maximal strength loads. Like that's like more power zone, as people say.
Yep.
You lift there. I still call that general strength, because it's coming nowhere close to the speeds you see at max velocity. It's also the nature of the activity. Like it's not reflexive. It's not involuntary. It's voluntarily controlled. Like there's so many involuntary things happening at max velocity, and the brain is not navigating those tasks the same way at all. So I think that's another important consideration. You're not training things like the reduction of muscle slack before ground contact, like stiffness before you hit the ground. Because the second you unrack a bar, your body is removing slack so that it can be stiff and stable so you don't collapse to the ground. It's a protective mechanism. So right off the bat, neurologically, you're not training the same thing. So like with the drop catch stuff that I've done, where like you're reflexively dropping down, purposely relaxing fast and then braking, that's similar to kind of what we see in sprinting theoretically. You're relaxing so that your limb speed can accelerate and be fast. And then there's an active firing into the ground, but then the limb has to relax so that it can move fast.
Yeah.
And there's a paradox between force, tension, and relaxation. So like when muscles produce tension, they produce force, but tension slows down movement. However, high velocity is extremely forceful.
Yeah.
So like that's a paradox. Why is that? Because we're not actively controlling every degree of freedom throughout a sprint, for example, or a plyometric.
Yeah.
And even like some of the stiffness benefits, like it's actually coming out that like the stiffness we see in plyos is not actually an anatomical adaptation of the tendon. You're getting stiffer because of the intermuscular coordination around the joint. It's not even like a tendon adaptation. People say we're doing this for like tendon stiffness. No, you're not. What you're doing it for is you are developing the communication between the brain and the foot, or whatever joint structure you want to be stiff at contact, to produce a proper co-contraction to where the joint can function the way you want it to. You're not creating a tendinous adaptation.
Yeah.
If you want to get stiff tendons, you need to lift heavy shit for a long time is what you need to do.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do.
Yeah.
And so like people say, oh, I had an intern ask me the other day, I might be going off on a tangent, but I think all this stuff comes together because they all have something to do with each other. The intern asks me, diminishing returns, like, is that a real thing? Like, should you ever stop lifting and work, like focus on something else? And I'm like, well, that's kind of myopic to like say, oh, just because you're strong enough, never lift heavy again, or take like 8 to 12 weeks off from lifting heavy, because you can potentiate the nervous system by lifting heavy. You will stimulate collagen turnover in tendons if you lift heavy. They'll keep your tendons healthy. Psychologically, it's very healthy for you. Moving heavy weight is good for you, if you like to feel strong. Like my athletes sometimes in a power block, they're like, "Are we lifting heavy today?" I'm like, "No, we're going lighter, like deloading." They're like, "Oh, you know what I mean?" Like these athletes want to lift heavy, and you know, that doesn't mean you just give it to them all the time, but
There's
yeah, I'm
a
just
huge confidence piece from lifting heavy that like is
yeah.
psychological that like it yeah. That's
For
a
sure.
really good way to approach quote unquote diminishing returns, 'cause like diminishing returns for a specific quality might occur in a certain amount of time, but for you as an organism, like there's just you're gonna spend a lot of time in the quote unquote, I was just thinking about this today. You're gonna spend a lot of time in the quote unquote plateau of some
Yeah.
physical quality while maybe bringing up another physical quality so that you can ultimately bring up the other that first physical quality again, right? Like
Yeah.
I think about that all the time. And you know, because like where I f when I first started coaching as a physical therapist, I was a little bit like, it's just I do like working with powerlifters. Powerlifting is not very complicated. Powerlifters like to make it complicated, and it's okay, but like a lot of the people that I've seen in powerlifting, and even with some of the people that I coach with powerlifting, I'm like, you have reached this point where you have to get athletic again, or you have to get more athletic so that you can get better at powerlifting, because you're just running yourself in the wall against the
Yes.
same physical qualities, where it's like, and it's not like that we're not going to stop squatting and deadlifting and bench pressing, but like you're going to benefit from becoming a more well-rounded organism.
Yeah.
And but that's not how a lot of people do it. And then no wonder people get burnt out or they get hurt at XYZ to some extent, right? So
Yeah. So two quick things, like one is that I think diminishing returns is not a problem for the average person. Like it becomes a problem when you just mismanage your training and you're overemphasizing things. Like, you know, if I'm trying to focus on something else, I'm just going to focus on maximal strength less. It's not, I'm the volumes are going to change, the intensity is going to change, the frequency is going to change, but I'm still going to focus on it to a degree. The other thing with how my point about this myopic vision of being strong enough and diminishing returns is like, what about all the hormone benefits you get from lifting heavy? Like testosterone, insulin growth factor one, like all these different hormones that we get that help us become robust organisms and contribute very positively to our overall health and our functionality as an athlete. Like, we're just going to forget about all those things. Like, I think that's also important to consider as well.
No, it's a super good. It's a super. I mean, that's why I like talking to people like you, because it like just oh, it's like I'm going down a path, and like you just your knowledge right there just like unlocked like a little bit of a like a to continue on that path, right? Because I think also like I don't know if you call it concurrent training or whatever you I just kind of call it like. Nothing. I think you said there's a place for it. I'm just looking at you're like there's a place for a lot of stuff, and it's just how much of it are you doing, right? Like you know, I just went and ran my dog for 20 minutes in a field. It's like, oh yeah, like if me as a human, if I can't tolerate 20 minutes of jogging around as a field, like that's a pretty big chink in my armor as a human being, right? Yeah, if I was a 400 dude getting paid to just be push people around, like maybe that's not something I want to work on. But even then, you know, who knows? So,
Yeah, well, the point of that, like there's a place for it post was what I was trying to say with that was, you know, we have so much information at our fingertips that we could, so, like, someone could make a good argument for anything. That doesn't mean that it should dominate the program or that you need to be doing it.
That's a good point.
It absolutely does not mean either of those things just because you can demonstrate value for something. Because if you can demonstrate value for everything, then how do you determine what's more important? Like, then we're talking about, okay, well, what has more value? And now we're getting into arguments about, well, you know, you need to discard some stuff so that you know what to do. So that was the point of that post, is like, yeah.
I got the meaning of that post wrong from the title, but I get
No,
your point.
it's all good. So like people say, like with the drop catch method stuff, it's like, yeah, it has some value. I see what you guys are trying to do, but does that mean that we should be letting it dominate everything else and taking us away from the general things like lifting heavy and with stuff we've been talking about?
What? Who are you mentioned a few people that I you mentioned Charlie Francis, you mentioned mentioned Fergus Connolly. Who are your other influences and who are you learning from now? And like also what are the things you're just thinking about more and more? What's like I kind of think everybody develops their own philosophy a little bit. So like where's your philosophy taking you?
Well, to answer your first question, I think Will Ritell is a really good resource. I like it. He's got some short, like 2 to 5 minute videos on YouTube, like hundreds of them. I've gone through like most of them. I like his approach to training because it's simple, it's effective. I like Blaine McConnell, also known as Story Pobby on Instagram. I do like Joel Smith. I like James Smith. James Smith wrote a book called Governing Dynamics of Coaching, which is my favorite strength training book of all time, for sure. And I like it because of the philosophy he has. And it's not even so much the training methods that he has in there, but he talks about specificity. He talks about like the big buckets that we're trying to cover right now. He talks about ill-advised like conditioning tests and like the current state of performance and why those things are not optimal for athletes and why they have nothing to do with the tactical or technical elements of the game, things like that. I like Fergus Connolly's Game Changer book. And for the most part, I really like webinars. I mean, I've been a member of Strength Coach Network for a long time, and Zach Dakin also has a really great baseball performance summit he puts out every year. That's very high quality. I kind of just mix and match who I get my stuff from. I wouldn't say I pull from one resource all the time. You asked me another question after that. You said, "What's my philosophy?" Is that what
Yeah,
you asked me?
you're kind of, 'cause that's kind of what I like too, is I like to try to blend to get, I like to see what people are saying and where things compare and contrast, and then try to make it into my own, like, you know, try to find my own kind of philosophy with it, I guess is the best word I can say. Yeah. So, yeah.
Philosophy is such a big word. Like, are you looking more for like methods
Maybe.
or?
Yeah. Like I, you, maybe your underlying method, maybe your underlying philosophy is more like, humans have a shit ton of potential and we actually need to push into that. That's probably what it seems like for you. But yeah, maybe methods and is a better way
Yeah,
to look at it.
I mean, I think one of my philosophies is that the human body is way more capable of what we think. I think that actually the dawn of performance science is actually a reason why injuries are very high right now because we're emphasizing recovery too much. I'm not saying that performance science is bad, but I think that its integration with performance training is not mastered yet. It's not, I don't think it's close. I think, one thing that I adopt is like a frequency model. So you have like, there's this dichotomy between like frequency-based training and saturated-based training. I got this from Mladen Jovanovic, who's actually another really good influence. I forgot to mention his name. So when you adopt like a saturation model, it's like you have two like super high days and then the rest of the days you're resting. So like you tank the athletes on those days. And then you got a frequency model where it's like, okay, strong stimulus, but in low dose. Wait a day, strong stimulus, low dose. Next day, moderate stimulus, moderate dose or moderate volume. So, one thing that I'm tinkering with and like a belief that I have is that the frequency of competition in a sport should have something to do with like how you lay out the frequency of training. Like softball athletes, we're expecting our athletes to play like 4 games in a row or like maybe 5 games in a week. But we only train them high intensity twice a week. I don't think that works. Like in season, I'm sprinting them 4 days a week before practice. We adopt a frequency model in season with our speed development, but our strength work, you know, we only do 2 days a week because that's all we have really time for. But I do think that that's very important to consider. I think my overarching philosophy, if I could sum it up in a couple of sentences, is I want to prepare athletes at the highest speed I possibly can. I think that speed is the one thing that reigns supreme over everything. Speed of the interpretation of the game, and just providing a lot of movement options and a lot of different challenges athletically. Like we play a lot of games in the weight room. Like I would love to play things like spike ball. Like we've played wall ball. We've played different games with tennis balls that I've just come up with. Like just challenging them to be dynamic human beings and not just adapted to a program, but adaptable. Like whatever you give them, they will be able to learn that thing and execute it proficiently in a short amount of time because they have the skill set to learn fast. Variation is big for me when appropriate. Like I said before, I'm not trying to change things all the time. I don't know, man. The philosophy question is tough. Like I'm trying to get people as fast as humanly possible, jump as high as possible. Lift as heavy as they possibly can comfortably. I mean, like it's kind of simple.
Well, it's like, okay, so like, I want to ask you a question on like the dude. It's crazy how good sports are for like how good of a learning model sports are. Meaning, like, another thing I like to do is I'm getting into tennis, and the dude. So I go and I play. I try to. I had a kid 12 weeks ago, so I haven't got to play tennis. I can play basketball because basketball's in the morning. Tennis is at night, which is different. But I show up and I'm like, it's like a lot of games, right? It's not straight up tennis. It's like, hey, situational type stuff. And but I asked one of the guys, he's like clearly a good tennis player. He's like, how do I hit a topspin forehand? And he's like, well, man, how long you been doing this? I'm like, 6 weeks or whatever. He's like, dude, just keep showing up playing these games and you're gonna get way better. And then like you'll start to just naturally figure out how to move the ball, right? But his point was like, if you play challenging games, you're gonna learn fast, right? If you just try to come and hit a top fence spin forehand, you're gonna like just get, it's like what we were saying about Goodhart's law, right? But the question, like playing games in the weight room, I don't know if you ever get kickback against this, because I've heard people say like I kind of do you follow Austin Yokum? Austin Yokum,
Yes, I do.
like
Yeah,
he,
of course.
spike ball and dunks before they start to actually train, or it's part of training.
Yeah, I think that stuff is sick.
It's genius because it's like the best warm up, because it's fun, high intent, and it gets your brain ready to go do another task that maybe is a little bit more like, it's more like output oriented, right? But how, what is it about games that makes people adaptable that will ultimately contribute to their sport or the weight room performance? Like, which weight room performance is supposed to move you to better sport performance, right? So,
I think the games are unpredictable. I think that's what it comes down to.
yeah.
They're unpredictable, they're competitive, there's a goal, and you need to react. I think that's the biggest thing. It's like if sport is unpredictable, and we're talking about how unpredictableness or things like that, an interpretation of an environment or a space is going to impact injuries, like why would we just cookie cut everything and make everything predictable? That's I think the extent of my answer.
Yeah. No, it also keeps the brain, I mean, it's what you're just saying, but like keeps the brain engaged long enough to like, all right, let's settle into this. Like, not settle into this, but like, yeah, let's get cracking and get going. Like playing soccer, I played soccer in high school, and we do, I mean, like, it's not a critique, it's kind of a critique of our coaching, but it was like we'd play like these kind of like shitty warm-up type of, or they'd be like just kind of shitty drills that like didn't really do anything. But when we would actually scrimmage or like play small, like you were saying, kind of small set game type of stuff, our engagement would go up so much, right? And the stuff we were doing before that was just like shit that our coach had read in a manual about how you're supposed to coach soccer drills, right? And the other stuff was actually us playing soccer, right? Which is what made us better soccer players in the long run. So dude, I love it. What, all right, so you're gonna break 22 miles per hour this year, or did you
Yeah,
already do it?
I think it's gonna take a couple months. I'm at 21.6. It's probably gonna take a couple months because I was sick last week and I had like a week and a half off because I got engaged in December and then I went on a vacation with my fiance and her family. So it was tough to keep myself going, but now I'm back in like a GPP phase and I'm gonna ramp back up. So hopefully hit it this spring or summer when it's warm out.
There you go. How far out do you plan your training?
Oof. I mean, Well, I can answer this by talking about my philosophy a little more.
There you go. All right.
I think one more thing that goes into my philosophy is like every single week is an experiment.
Yeah.
Every week is an experiment, and for that reason, like you don't know how long something's going to work for, nor do you know what the exact response is going to be. So, for myself, I lay a general template out for 2 weeks, and I pretty much write a new like program every week, like for that week. How did last week go? What am I trying to do? Am I trying to overreach myself? Am I trying to progress in volume load or intensity? Like those are just some things that I'm thinking about. Am I trying to really progress speed this week? Okay, if so, I'm not going to progress the lifting. I'll just keep that the way it is, and I'm just going to progress the speed stuff a little bit. So it's just pretty much like going off of how things went like the last week. Sometimes I program a little longer than that. Just so I can see visually like my direction, but I don't have anything set in stone. If that answers your question.
I think that that was a beautiful answer, because I think direction is really important, but I think like adaptability or like course correcting very well is like kind of the name of the game, right? Especially when it's just kind of, well, I think it sounds like you think about this as well, and even just from you talking about like what you care about being able to do, like you want to be able to demonstrate and exude what you're asking anybody to perform, right? You know, it's tricky, like, to be the experiment, and because maybe you tinker too much and you're not going in the direction you want to go, but that's also like learning to manage the feedback loops that you're creating as well, right?
I mean, before 2024 ended, I was doing the drop catch method and all the AFSM stuff from Cal Dietz and s things that were similar to that. I forgot where I was freaking going with that.
Okay.
I think I was gonna say some good.
If you were gonna name your system, because that's one of the things I just also see too, is like people create a system, and then ultimately we kind of either say these are the things I like about this system, or I'm gonna throw away, right? But if you were gonna say like this is the it's Padula, right? I said your last name correct when I opened it up. If this is the Padula system, what would the big overarching things be in the Padula system?
I think it would be tons of jumps, tons of plyos, a lot of loaded accelerations, top end speed sprinting, like true top speed. I think some people like they go, we're developing max velocity and they run out to like 30 yards. Like, have you ever done a 60 yard sprint? Like stuff like that. I think is a little different. I think also a little lower volume strength training than you probably think. And you can get away with that if you sell out on those sets. Like a lot of my programs have like, you know, four working sets for the main lift and then two working sets for the accessories. But like we're pushing to like 0 to 1 RIR. Like
Yeah.
I think a
Okay.
lot of people, like especially my athletes, they look at a program like if it has four sets on it, for example. They're like, oh, I got to preserve my energy to get through four sets. But if you have two sets, it's like, okay, I only have to go balls to the wall for two sets. It ends up being a little better. And you actually do a little less volume, but the training effect is better. So I think people sometimes are surprised by how low volume my strength training is. But I'm no weaker than anybody else who I think would advocate for like more volume. Like it's not a bodybuilding program style that
Yeah.
I'm adopting.
Yeah.
I think you would see less exercises than you probably expect. Like some programs, you open them up, there's like 8, 9 exercises a day.
Yeah.
Like today I did 3 lifting exercises and then I did like 2 exercises for my groin and hip flexor, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a little less overall work like visually, but the quality I think is just I'm trying to preserve quality as best I can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's two components of that. I want to train forever, right? If the longer I train and the more I can do quality sessions, the more it's gonna compound. Whereas like volume is just, it's just starts to, you start to flirt with your ego, right? Like, hey, I got 5 sets of 8, and you know, you just do something stupid on set 4 or set, you know, and it's like, it's always being smart, but I think, like minimum effective dose type of stuff, but also Will Rattell has a really good video on like minimum effective dose, And then also just the effective reps. Like, a lot of people aren't doing very effective reps in that five sets, right? And it's like, well, if you just do 2 to 3 sets and you know, you're pushing into some effective reps, you're going to get a good stimulus, right?
That's a really good point with the effective reps. And the other thing too is, like, you're trying to sprint fast. I mean, if you're killing yourself in the gym on Monday or Tuesday, like, I'm telling you, it will affect your speed on Thursday or Friday.
Yeah,
it will. Like, you got to be very careful and, like, understand how the previous session is impacting the next. That's another thing is, like, if I'm trying to sprint 2 to 3 times a week, I can't be doing 4 sets of 8 on RDLs. Like, it's not going to do well for you if you're trying to move fast.
Man, this has been a really good conversation. I appreciate your time and coming on. I definitely want to have you back because you've definitely made me think about a bunch of stuff, which I really like, and I appreciate it. Where can people feel you? Where can people find you? And pitch yourself here near the end, my friend.
Yeah. First of all, I'd love to come back. I really appreciate you having me. When you learn more and you get deeper into the rabbit hole, I'd love to come back and talk more. But yeah, people can find me at Pedulla Performance on Instagram. That's PEDULLA Performance. You could email me at joe.pedulla@pedullaperformance.com. A lot of the stuff that we've talked about today is stuff that I cover in my course, Pragmatic Principles. It's $147. It's a great resource. It gives you access to me 100%. You'll get access to a Discord that's got now, I think, like 60 coaches in it that I started this week. So that's going to be our little community. And that's going to keep getting a lot better and better. There will be a mentorship coming soon in the next year or two, and there will be a part two eventually. So that's going to be very exciting in years to come.
Let's go, man. Good stuff. I've scoped your mentorship. I like to learn from people. It's fun and exciting, and that's a steal, man. You got to up those prices on that mentorship, man. But no,
people. Well, yeah, I think the mentorship's going to be a lot more than the course is at right
now.
Yeah,
the course got you with the course. Yeah, yeah.
Because
make sure that mentorship price is the
mentorship is going to be like 12 90-minute sessions. It's going to be heavy. That's so awesome. I'm excited for that. I think that's the direction I'm going to go. And then based off the response from that, I'll develop a part two, which is going to be called Principles in Practice, which is going to be more like protocols. Like, here's what to do. Here's how I progress things like that. Instead of the theoretical aspect that I take in part one.
Yeah.
Where we just talk about, like, how to think is pretty much the root of the entire course is just, here's how you think and manage the situation. In part two, I'm going to show you, like, how I actually do it. So
I like that you said that, because I think so many people start with the protocols and then they never learn to think. And I think learning to think, if you learn to think, then you can start to look at a protocol and be like, this is what it's doing, and this is how I adapt it for my situation. Because, like, people need protocols, right? We need like stepwise processes, but those things are just like any other model. They're not perfect, right? We need to learn to manage them. And if you can't think, then you're screwed, right?
Right.
Good stuff. All right, really quick. 3 favorite things to do in the weight room. Sorry, I should ask this earlier, but, like, what do you like? You design, like, these are my big 3. What are they?
Is sprinting included?
Yes.
Sprinting, for sure. Top end speed sprinting, flying 10s.
Yeah.
Back squats, for sure. And chin-ups, loaded chin-ups.
A good program right there. You could get pretty fit just doing those 3 things.
You could get some decent progress on those 3 things alone for a while.
it's powerful. Hey man, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here, and thanks so much.
Yeah, of course, man. Thank you for having me.
Yep, peace.
See ya.